Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. Coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where today's guest is Pam Genoff. I had the opportunity to interview Pam a couple of years ago at the Morristown Festival of Books, and it was such a great conversation. And it was about her last book. And I was so looking forward to having a reason to talk to her again. So I'm glad she wrote another book so we could do that. And not only is this her latest book, it's her latest New York Times bestseller, The Woman with the Blue Star. So welcome, Pam. It is so great to see you again.
It is great to see you. Not as great as when I get to see you in person when we can hug again, but it will have to do for now. Thank you for having me.
Isn't it? It just feels like a lifetime ago since we were anywhere.
It is.
So let's start with you telling us a little bit about The Woman with the Blue Star. Tell us a little bit about the background on the book.
So The Woman with the Blue Star, oh, look, I even have one. That's crazy. Oh. I never have one. The Woman with the Blue Star is my 11th book. And if you're familiar with my work, which I know you are, Carol, but many people may not be, centers around World War II and the Holocaust. And so this book in particular was inspired by a true story of a group of Jewish people who survived World War II by hiding in a sewer. And I don't mean hiding like they ran through the sewer on their way out. They lived in the sewer for more than a year. And so hearing about this, I was personally captivated. How did they live and who helped them? What was it like? And I was captivated by an anecdote of a young girl who looked up through the sewer grate and she saw a girl her own age buying flowers. And she was so struck by the disparity in their lives. And her mother said to her, "Someday there will be flowers." And so that was the jumping off point for my book. I imagined what would happen if the girl in the sewer and the girl on the street had had the chance to meet one another. And what would that have meant for both of their lives?
Wow. Wait, now, at what point during the war were these people living in the sewer? Was it the 42, like when you set the book, or was it later?
Well, I'm going to tell you, so the actual people who lived in the sewer were in Lviv, Poland, or Lviv, right on the border. And my story is set in Krakow, Poland. So that affected the timeline. And I don't want to get the dates wrong because I had to look at when the Krakow ghetto was liquidated and make that accurate. Lviv, you're still in that same time period in the, you know, I'm going to say 42-ish, but I don't want to get it wrong. But Lviv was one of the cities that was liberated quite early in the war, and so by the Soviets. And so actually, make sure it was by the Soviets, but I think that's right. So actually, in real life, some of the people who survived the sewer, were kind of liberated en masse as a group and got to come up onto the street. And that was an image I did not get to use in the book that was so powerful to me, of these people coming out of the sewer, and it was like the sunlight was blinding, and it was really powerful.
Well, I have to tell you that I don't think I'll walk past a sewer again. I mean, we were out for a walk the other day and you're looking and just picturing people living under there. And when you were describing the smells, you were describing the being wet all the time, the fear of the rush of water that would come through the spring rains and whatever. And it was just this existence that we don't really think about, of like fortitude, of this is what you have to do. And when you were reading about these people, I know you're seeing the image of the flowers. Was there a lot about what it was like to live under the ground? Was there a lot about that?
There was. So, you know, first I find that the moment, and I call it the aha moment, because if I can find an idea that after 25 years of working with the war makes me go, then I'm hopeful that my readers will feel the same way. So the aha is finding the sewer. And then I start digging for resources. And if you're lucky as a historical fiction author, you find that one book, nonfiction, right? A treatise, a research reference book that has what you need. And there was a book called In the Sewers of Lviv by Robert Marshall. And that book had the detail, how wide were the pipes and, you know, did they have light and did they have water and what were the many dangers they faced? And so all of that detail, although my story is fictitious, all of that detail I strive to be accurate with. And that came from real sources.
Wow. Wow. So you find this book, it's like this gold. It's like, oh, okay, what happened here? What's happened there? Did you have to have drawings of what the sewer would look like when you're describing what they would be crawling through? Or was it all in your head?
Well, there are pictures. There are actual pictures. I've had a few on my website. And then there was this book, and the book had maybe not pictures of the sewer, it had more pictures of the people and the things going on. And then I was actually, since my story's set in Krakow, I was all set to go to Krakow for research and meet the sewer experts and all of that. And my plane ticket was booked for March 11th of 2020, right? So you can feel that right there, that as things were getting worse and people were saying, "Oh, Pam, I don't know if you should go." I was like, I'm going to wear the mask because there was no other way to do it. My flight was canceled, right? And so I didn't get to go, but I'm very lucky. I lived in Krakow for more than 2 years, and I still have friends there, including in the US consulate in Krakow. And so those same friends that were helping me set up my trip then pivoted and helped me get in touch with the experts remotely, the sewer expert, the city expert. And they did this for me all as their own city was shutting down from COVID. So it was very, very special.
Oh my gosh, I have goosebumps thinking of that, of like people just going, I'm going to go pitch in. But also there was another reason that it was a good reason that you ended up staying home because what, you have this emergency
Yeah, so
plan?
I left. I was supposed to leave on March 11th and my flight got canceled. I was all bummed. March 12th, I had an emergency appendectomy. And so I would have been in the air over Central Europe somewhere when that happened. So I feel fortunately I had it right here in the United States. I came home from the hospital the next day and the whole world had shut down. Like my kids' schools were closed. It was a very Rip Van Winkle moment. And then like we never left the house for 6 months, you know? So it was very odd. I'm very lucky.
It was so strange because we closed our office, I guess, on the 10th. On the 11th, Austin got sick. I think on the 12th or the 13th, I got sick, and we were all sick. And we were just there, like, okay, I guess we've had it at the beginning of COVID. Here we are. But now, like, we're still dealing with this. How many months later? It was just a real, it was, there were just such crazy days. If you sit there and think back on it, it was just, okay, what are we going to do next? Including,
Remember when
I'm
we
not
thought it
going
was 2 weeks?
home.
It was supposed to be 2 weeks to flatten the curve. But you know, it was actually very interesting writing this book while I was home during the pandemic, because while what we went through is nothing like what people went through during the war at all, we were suddenly very isolated in our homes and seeking connections right as my characters were doing the same thing. And I found myself asking questions last March that I never imagined I would ask in 2020, like how to keep my family safe and how to educate my children, and can we get meat and toilet paper? You know, and it just reminded me that what these parents during the war that were suddenly faced with, you know, with these base level survival questions, their lives really changed in an instant.
It was overnight, and it was, how are you going to survive? What are you going to do? And what's important? You started narrowing down. I mean, once the toilet paper was under control, it's like, what is important? What really matters? How are we going to do it? Also, I remember what you were saying in your author's note that this book was, there was a book before this. There was a book that you wrote and it didn't actually work out.
Oh, it was this
And
book is the problem.
this book is the pro, this book is
So
that book.
I wrote a first draft of this book and I turned it in late 2019. And after 11 books, this was the stinker. This was the clunker. This is the one where my beloved editor, you know, looked at me and said, "No." And I'll never forget this moment, Carol. I was coming back from somewhere because I teach law school. So I was coming back from somewhere law related and I had to stop and take the call with my editor. I needed to write, I needed to concentrate. I pulled into a Bob Evans off of the highway. Like this is probably the only time in my life I've been in a Bob Evans, right? And so I pull in, I get my notebook out and she like delivers that, you know, she drops the hammer, right? That about how much we're going to need to fix in this book. And it was like, I threw out 95% of the book. That is a lot of 5 a.m. wasted. That's a
That's a
lot of
lot.
sleep wasted, right? That I had written that never went anywhere. And I had to rewrite the whole thing in 5 months, which would have been fine. And then right in the middle of the 5 months, it's COVID. So, I don't remember much of that time period, but I do remember wringing my hands for like 10 minutes about this big project I had to take on, and then thinking of the line from The Godfather, which is something like, this is the business we have chosen, you know? And then I just said about it.
I could not be a novelist. Maybe this would be okay. When once you talk to her, because you, the editor author relationship is something that always intrigues me. Did you see what she was talking about right away, or did it take your peeling back the layers to understand it's not going to work the way I have it?
I always see it. My editor and I have a very, my editor, my agent and I, it's kind of like a trifecta. We have a very close trust relationship. My editor and I, we wanted to work together before she was even at my house. So it was pure kismet and it's been that way ever since. And everything she says is right. Like, there's not even a question. So I always agree with her, but there's this moment of denial. There's this thud in your stomach when you realize exactly how much work is going to be involved to achieve her vision and what she wants you to change. That's, it's not the agreeing, it's just like getting past how much you're going to have to do.
Right, right. Well, you know, I remember talking to William Kent Kruger and Melanie Benjamin both saying that they actually put whole books aside. Like, they actually finished writing the book and wrote something completely different. Yeah. And they said their career and their writing was better for it. But there was that painful moment that how many 5 a.m. mornings or how many 1 o'clock a.m. nights did you spend that it just didn't work. But when you realize that you're doing your craft and you really want an editor to be saying to you, I want you to be your best. I want you to do this and I want it to work. That's a gift in a lot of ways, because a lot of times that doesn't end up happening. It really, it's like, okay, just let it go. You can tell when it's let it go, you know?
Yeah, no, we're all working toward, it's a shared goal, absolutely.
So what did remain from that book? What's the 5%?
Well, let me tell you what changed. It's probably, because there's so much to change, it's probably easier to talk about what changed. So my editor had two really important visions. I had written this book with a relatively brief time in the sewer, and then I had taken it after liberation into the post-war. My editor wanted more time in the sewer to build those relationships. So that was the first major change. And the second really major change is my first draft, the book was entirely from Sadie's point of view, the girl in the sewer. And it was my editor who said, no, we need to see Sadie and Ella both.
And you need to see them going back and forth with each other, what you'll learn from one about the other, what they're going to be sharing, yeah, the longing, the... And you also are seeing that Ella does not have the best life either. You're realizing that, you know, Sadie's stuck in the sewer. Ella's stuck in her life. Her father's passed away, just to give people a little bit of time frame. Her stepmother has taken over the house that they live in, and she is consorting with the enemy. Like, basically, there's the synopsis of where Ella is. So one person's trapped in the sewer. The other one's trapped in her life.
And her fiance. Let's not forget about the boyfriend / fiance who Ella thought was off fighting in the war and discovers he's back. And for reasons that I won't spoil, hasn't told her that he's back. So she's alone and jilted.
Yeah. It's like, okay, this is exactly what we're doing. We're, you know, nowhere or whatever. You know, flooding was something that they feared. And you walk the reader through that more than once, because it's this fear of being, you know, swallowed up by the water, of, you know, having to cling. And you feel the way you're writing, it's, I feel like I am in that water. I feel the water rising. I feel their anxiety. Is that something that would happen just with the spring rains? Or, I mean, when I think of the sewer, it's like somebody flushes the toilet and it goes into the sewer, you know?
So first of all, let me say, I feel this with you, Carol. I can't swim. Like, we have a pool in the backyard. My whole family swims and I like sink like a stone. And when I was little, I used to have those dreams of like the ocean coming over my head, the waves, right? So I feel this very personally. I was surprised to learn that the sewer was something of an underground city. You've got big tunnels, like, you know, you could drive a car through, and you've got little pipes called 40s, which you'd lay down and try your best to shimmy through without getting stuck. So you've got all these things. You've got little trickles of water, and you've got great big raging kind of rivers of water running through it. So it's impossible for me to say what would trigger a particular rise in the water. It can be spring rains. It can be melting snow. It can be someone opens up kind of a levee somewhere in the sewer system for some reason and lets water come through. But these were very real dangers that occurred for people. If you read the nonfiction account, there were people who drowned. There were waters that rose. That all actually happened. And they were just among the myriad dangers that these people live through, you know, detection, starvation, and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then we've got Sadie's mom pregnancy, which brings another kind of urgency to the story, because we're known, I'm thinking immediately when this baby comes, there's going to be noise and that will attract people going back into the sewer, like what's going on there. And I feel that part of the story almost ratcheted the suspense up even another notch. Was she always pregnant? Was that something that was always a part of the book?
So in real life, one of the women in the sewer was pregnant. Mm. And that is a real story. And the noise you are afraid of was a very real fear for them, right? That the baby was going to make noise and, you know, all of that. And so I needed that in the story. It was a very compelling element. The way it works out in my story and the way it worked out in real life are very, very different. I will say that.
Yeah. And what I also thought that it was reminding me that life was going on in the midst of war. And we forget about that.
Absolutely. So, I don't ever set out to write romance. I will jokingly say I'm pretty bad at it. My editor would say it's tertiary at best in my books. But in reality, the reason there are relationships and the reason these things are happening is because these are young women, and that those things happened even during war. Those were actual accounts. And so, in order to give a full picture, you're going to have people falling in love and babies being born and all of that.
Yeah, Sadie at one point talks about thinking about when they hit the sewers, time above them stopped. And then she realized that life went on without them, without people taking notice. And I thought a lot about that because we think a lot about the neighbors who lived near us when we were growing up. Like we lived in one neighborhood for a very long time. Where are those people now? What's happened? Blah, blah, blah. And I also know that after the war, a lot of people were thinking about their family, but were they also tracking the friends from the neighborhood, like the people that were left behind? And it had me thinking about that so much because we define our lives in so many ways, and one is neighbors and friends besides family.
Yes, and one thing I want to show through all these different people and communities is that I don't ever want to paint history with a broad brush stroke. I don't like the black and white. I want the gray in there. And so you're going to see all of these different individuals and all of their different responses to war and crisis, individual responsibility. Do I help? Do I stand by? Or do I consort like the stepmother did? And so you've got all of these different kinds of responses going on in these communities of friends and neighbors. And the people aren't all the same, like the Jewish characters, right? There's Orthodox and there's less religious. And among the Polish people, for example, there are the city people and there are the villagers, all the stratification that existed.
Well, I think his pronunciation name is Chris,
Yes,
Krys,
Chris is
Chris.
fine.
Chris
Yes.
at one point said, "This is war. Every one of us has to make compromises. Like, no matter where you are, whether you're which side you're on or whatever, you're making compromises." And I thought that was such a great line because it's not like there's just winning and losing. Everybody's going to lose something somewhere along the way.
Yeah, it's all about the dire circumstances and stark choices of war. And I want to take the reader and put my reader in the shoes of Sadie or Ella or Chris and have that reader say, "What would I have done?" Like that compelling choice.
I was thinking that throughout the book is what would I have done? Because I was not growing up to be a risk taker. I was not, trained to be a risk taker or whatever. And I think that if it's a book club discussion about this book, that's the one thing you'd be saying is, which one would you have done? Which person would you have been? Would you be the person that'd be smuggling this? Would you be fearful to be doing that? Or would you say, I have to be brave to help somebody else? And I don't know, I go back and forth on how I would feel.
So I'm not brave. I think Dorothy should have stayed in Oz because it was easier than fight. Like I'm like, Oz is a nice place. Like, why does she have to fight her way back? Like I'm kind of a chicken. So I make light of that, but I do mean it seriously because I lived in Poland and I was living right on top of the war. Like to get my car fixed at a mechanic, I had to drive past the camp from Schindler's List. And so, there were lots of, I had a really positive experience there. But there were a lot of things that could produce a very visceral reaction. So you hear an old world police siren, you see a crowd gathering, and suddenly you would want to just hide in your basement. And it really makes you think, what would I have done? Back then it made me think, but now I have children, it makes you think even more.
And if they were not here when something happened, how would you get to them? What would you do to get to them?
Yep.
What the fight would be? I mean, even with Sadie's mother and what happens, it's that push pull back and forth of she's still the mother. She's still the mother, and she's the mother of the baby and this much older child.
She's the mother with these choices. And I used to think about that a lot. So I have three kids and they're all within 17 months of each other because I have twins. And I'd have these three babies and I'd be sitting kind of in my living room in suburbia thinking like, when the invading army comes over that hill, like how do I overland carry three children? I mean, it's the kind of thing you think about as a mom.
Yeah, and it's always like, how will I protect them? I always equated on 9/11 of where was everybody? And the first thing you want to know is where were your kids and were they safe? Were they someplace? Where were they? How are they feeling? Should I go get them now? What should I do? And I think that that's our, like, our moment, even though we were not, directly impacted. But I just felt like, the whole time I was reading the book, it was, okay, how would I do this? What would I do? Would I go down in the sewer to start with? I don't know. I'm
Yeah.
not sure. Even if your
Right. It was
characters
like
didn't
a,
go.
just these choices and every path you make the wrong choice, and there were just these really extreme consequences for your family.
Yeah. And Ella's brother's in Paris and he gets Ella a visa to travel there. Was it that much safer in Paris at that point that he's saying, come, come?
No, I mean, things in France were really bad, but I think sometimes during war, first of all, if you are not Jewish, right? So Ella's not Jewish, nor is her brother, and you could make it to Paris and you weren't doing like resistance activities, could you have flown below the radar with some amount of deprivation? Probably. So I think in some sense, the way that the Germans subjugated Poland may have been more extreme, and I'm not diminishing the suffering of the French experience, but may have been more extreme in what they did in Poland. It's also very relative what you perceive in history as better and worse. So let me give you a quick example if I can digress. I love post-war, like Paris, Berlin, post World War I, right? So there's this like Weimar Germany, right, in the early 1920s. Well, Jewish people thought that was like the center of the world. It was cosmopolitan. They thought that that was their place. They were safe. And so then you have hindsight, right, that it really wasn't at all. So I feel that same way as like thinking Paris is better, at least slightly, if you could get there, would be maybe a relative comparison.
Yeah, and also she really doesn't have family where she is right now. She doesn't have family with her stepmother, and her stepmother is just unbelievably cruel of the things that she's doing. And the way also in the whole house, the housekeeper's watching her, her mother, stepmother's watching her. They're watching her every move. Like, why did you go to that place in town? Why were you there? Is people saw you. You were not supposed to be doing this. And it's a lot of everyone is watching you. And I felt like nobody could just walk the street. Everybody's going to know you were gone. They were going to know that you were doing something.
And so let me say, now that you say that, I haven't thought about it before, but it might be reflective of my own experience. Krakow is like a beautiful big city, but it's also kind of like a small town, especially in the center. So when I went to Poland in 1996, I was one of eight Americans, right? And everybody knew who you were. And like, someone once remarked to a Polish person, like we saw, Pam from the consulate wearing sweatpants the other day. Do you think she was running? So it was very much like living in the fishbowl. And so I wonder if some of that reflects in Ella's experience there.
Yeah, because it was definitely, she's going to go out. Why are you going? What are you taking? And everybody is counting the food. Like, if I felt like if there was a crumb missing, there was going to be like a trial over where did that crumb of food go? Where did you take this? What did you do? And her stepmother is consorting with the enemy to get certain things that work for her. How many people were there? A number of people that were doing that when you've done research? Was that a small number of people?
So it would be really impossible to say, right? So my thing about the war is all about individualized responses, right? So I don't know, like it's hard to say this group did this or that. So I don't have any documentation of it. It's also responses were different from country to country, right? So some countries probably, and I don't want to generalize, there may have been more people in Austria who collaborated, right? Clearly in places like the Netherlands or Holland, collaborators were ostracized by society. So it very much is a national response. And I never know how to answer that question for Poland, because I loved Poland. I had a wonderful time there, but that's not always a prevailing view among Jewish people, right? So they have a certain view of the past. And so it's really interesting. On one hand, Poland has more Jews, more, sorry, I'm going to misspeak, more people in the righteous Gentiles in Yad Vashem than any other country, right? Because the war was there. But on the other hand, there's obviously a centuries-long pattern of anti-Semitism that can't be ignored. So I think collaboration is a really tricky question on a national level. All we can do is look at individualized responses.
Individual responses, what happened? When you were in Poland, you were there for 2 years?
A little over two, yes.
2 years. Was it a great experience being there? Like, was it, well, first of all, did you want to go? Like, when you were sent to the State Department, said you're going there, how did you feel?
So when you join the State Department, at least back then, I think it's changed, you enter with a class of people, like 30 people, and there's these jobs and you bid on them. And I think I'm the only person who wound up in Europe in that round. A lot of my friends were in Honduras and Nigeria. I wanted Krakow. I had been to Eastern Europe because before that I worked at the Pentagon and I had gone to Slovakia with my boss and I'd lived in England and I'd gone Euro railing in Prague. And I knew immediately that when I'm in Eastern Europe, I feel this sense of connection, and I would refer to it as what they call Yiddishkeit, like this sense of Jewishness, that it comes from our people lived there for 800 years. And so like there's this real connection to kind of the soil. And I love Eastern Europe, so Central Europe. So I asked for Krakow. I get Krakow. And then I realized I'm about to spend like multiple years of my life in Krakow. And it was a bit of a moment for me and my family. You know, I had a Russian grandmother who lived to be almost 94, who said like, why are you going back? We worked so hard to leave that part of the world. But I went, and it was hard. I mean, if you picture in 1996, we did not have cell phones. We did not have the internet. And so I went halfway around the world by myself, you know, and it was a really hard, really wonderful experience. I am so changed by it. And I still have such close connections to the country and the people and in my writing. So it was definitely a transformative experience. And I'm so happy I went.
Yeah, so you are happy. And then did you come back just because it was the end of the cycle of being there, or was it, I want to come home?
It was the end of my tour, and I was actually supposed to, I think, go to London next. And at that point, I was in my upper 20s. And, you know, I love the State Department. They are the finest people, finest group of people. My entering class, but for COVID, we would have had our 25-year anniversary last year, and we're all very, very close with one another, and I admire them so much. But for me, the lifestyle of foreign service in terms of wanting children and a family, in terms of being away from my own family for years at a time, was not for me. And so I said, look, I have no viable career option back home. And I wound up going back to the United States and going to law school after that.
Oh, so you went to law school later. I thought you
got
to law school.
Poland.
Oh, after you went back to law school. And then you were a lawyer for a while and then decided, like most people, I don't want to be a lawyer.
Well, so I love lawyers. I teach law school at Rutgers, yep. And I churn out baby lawyers. I mean, I love them, and I love my students. But what happened was, came back, I went to law school, and I'd always wanted to be a writer. I was a little kid who wanted to write. I never got started. So I graduate from law school, and I start working at a big firm in Philadelphia on September 4th, 2001. It was a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And 1 week later, 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And that was the aha moment for me, because I said, I've always wanted to be a writer. And if I had been a 9/11 victim, I never would have achieved my dream. I have to get started. Like, time is ticking. And mm-hmm. so I took a night course, and it was called Write Your Novel This Year. And I started working on Commandant's Girl. But the catch was that I was still a lawyer at a firm. And I still had $1,000 a month in student loan debt to repay. So I couldn't go be a writer. I had to write alongside and, you know, in the early mornings to make that happen. So I did. I was at a firm. I was in-house. And I've been on the faculty at Rutgers Law for about 12 years now.
Wow. And do you enjoy teaching?
Love it. But Rutgers is amazing. Our students are hardworking, unentitled, you know, some are first generation college, and it's a spectacular joy to help them get where they're going.
Yeah. And to just be saying, okay, these are the people, this is the next generation, and I'm grooming them.
There are some students that, I mean, I don't want to tell their personal stories, but there are a few students who I refer to as like the reason I teach, you know, there's a couple of those. So
ooh, I love that. I absolutely love that. So the book has a terrific ending that we're not going to discuss, but did you know you were heading there right from the start, or was that something that evolved along the way?
So I am a pantser, and I know you know what I mean, right? There's two kinds of writers, the plotters, who are the dear souls who outline and make everything look pretty, and the pantsers, who just like throw up words on a screen for months and months. And I'm a pantser, which means I have an idea and I just start throwing words down. And the reason that's important for your question is I'm never really sure what the beginning is versus what the end is, because it all happens at once. And so usually I have an opening image, I have some idea where I wind up, and then I have a couple of lighthouses along the way, like high moments I can see, but I don't really know much. And so I kind of knew with the prologue, epilogue, that was going to be the bookmark for the story, but what actually happens in that epilogue at the end was not predetermined and was surprising to me. And was that her answering without answering?
No, it's great. And was that in version one or no? Was that ending?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I'd have to go back and look, because version one was so different. I mean, right. They came to America. you know, they were out in the Midwest. Like I had them all over the place, and I really liked that, but it definitely wound up in a better place. So I would have to go back and look. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, we were talking to Kristen Hanna a couple of months ago, and she threw out 350 pages before the book that you saw now, The Four Winds. She had the
Oh my
story from a
goodness.
totally different point of view. Everything was completely different. And she did the same thing with The Great Alone. The Great Alone, that was the third version you see now. There were two other versions of that book.
Okay.
So I think that what it says is sometimes you just got to be making these changes in order to make the story completely work. The components are there, but it's sort of like you're putting a car together, and if you put the pieces in the wrong place, it's not going to run, and that's what ends up happening.
That's a brilliant analogy. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's just, well, believe me,
Thank
sometimes
God for cut and paste.
cut and paste. You know, I think about what writing must be have been like when all you were doing was handwriting. Though I was doing that in college because it was pre-computer days. It was electric typewriters. That's how old I am. And we would actually, I would be writing, and I would actually be cutting and pasting, like cutting and scotch taping the story back together, and then retyping it before I could take it to class. And I think about how much time would have just been saved if there were computers back. I would have gotten a lot more sleep when I was in college.
Oh yeah, I lugged a typewriter across Washington Square Park for my first year law school exams at NYU. I remember that, like a typewriter correction fluid. Yes. Oh my goodness, I could not have made it back then.
No, you just because it would have been like, oh, where are the pages? Where did they go? And I remember I used to be taping, and I used to go all the way across the floor, and then I'd reel it in to be typing before I'd go to class. It was the 11th hour all the time. And it's funny you say like 1996, that's when we started the book report, believe it or not. We were with one site on AOL back then.
I love serendipity like that. I
And
love
we
it.
were we were doing that because at the time, there was no place to learn about an author except the back of a book where it said, like, she lives in, you know, New Jersey with her husband and her children, or Pennsylvania with her husband and children, and she also teaches law. That would be that's all that you're going to know. Now you know everything about authors. You know what their backyard looks like. You know all these things. You didn't know that before. There wasn't that kind of communication at all.
Yeah, it's very special what we've built here. You know, first of all, congratulations on Book Reporter, which has always been here for my career. So I'm so lucky. But also, you know, all the incredible things that have happened during this past year, we laid the infrastructure for a decade before that, right? Because of social media, which for better or for worse, I love how it puts together readers, authors, and supporters and influencers, and we all had these connections. I've got reader friends for, you know, a decade, and so when everything fell last year, we were all able to pivot and connect, which is so special.
And that four-letter word Zoom became the best thing that happened in your life. Who would have known? I mean, think
Zoom for
about
the Nobel Prize.
what it
Zoom for
would
the
have been
Nobel
like
Prize.
if we did not have Zoom, if we did not have all these ways to connect. And I was doing this thing where I was putting up on my personal social media page, pandemic thought number 2553.
Oh.
I was doing these things kind of in order, but it was really funny. But at one point I said, but what if we all couldn't talk to each other right now? And how much lonelier would it have been in lockdown if you couldn't talk to any of your friends like this? If you
Yeah.
couldn't see each other's faces, you were seeing people, you were at least able to go do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. You've written extensively about World War II and the time immediately after, and I can understand why that, you know, takes you to place. Do you ever think about writing in a different time period?
So let me say I have written in a different time period. Of my 11 books, two were modern and one was kind of a modern historical hybrid, you know, jumping back and forth. I've also written other things than the war. So one of my earlier books, The Ambassador's Daughter, was set right after World War I. I also did one on the home front called The Last Summer at Chelsea Beach, which was Philadelphia and Atlantic City during the war. That was very fun. I have lots of ideas tucked away in a drawer that would never work in the 1940s. But there, as long as there are these stories that are give you the aha moment and are entertaining, are informational, and can be done respectfully, my heart's here. I think a lot of my readership has their heart here, and so I do the other stuff. There's just no time.
What do you think intrigues readers about that period of history? I mean, one of the women in our book group said, I will read any book about World War II. And she's in her early 40s. And she said, I will read any book about World War II. Just put them up. I love them.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think so. In order to think about why people want to read it, I think we go back to why people are writing it. Because maybe 7 years ago, I'm going to get the date wrong off the top of my head. We had this moment where I was having conversations about, like, is World War II played out? And it was right when Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale came out and Anthony Doerr, All the Light We Cannot See. And these are just such exceptional works. And you sort of say, can anybody do this after those two books? And then I looked over, and not counting those two books, four of the 15 on the New York Times were World War II books. So there was clearly still an appetite, and I think there still is. For me as a writer, it comes from three places. One, when I went to Poland in the 90s, like, communism had just fallen. And so in the past few decades since then, there's a lot of archival material that's available to researchers that was not available, you know, back in the day. And I think that's bringing forth new stories. Secondly, the survivors are really getting up there in years. And so we're trying to capture and tell these stories in whatever form we can. And then I think, you know, for the reader, I just want to put you in the shoes of my character. Your readers want to walk the steps and say, like, what would I have done? And if you take those dire circumstances and stark choices from the war, there's nothing quite like it for compelling stories.
Yeah, I think so. And I think heroism is something that we want to hear more about in the past year. I mean, how many times have we said essential workers are heroes? We're looking for heroes on so many different platforms, and especially from those who were in the shadows in the past. What do you hear from your readers about, like, have you been hearing anything about this book already? Have you heard, besides, you know, reading reviews on Goodreads and things like that? Notes? Well, you know,
I'm just starting to hear from readers on this book, but it's very interesting because I don't set out to write themes. And sometimes themes just kind of find you organically through the writing, whether it was The Orphan's Tale coming out in early 2016 with themes of sanctuary and refuge and, you know, moral responsibility right as the refugee crisis was unfolding. What Lost Girls of Paris was really kind of became the story of female empowerment right as the Me Too moment was exploding, you know? And so it's really about that. But across the books, I love how my characters before the war would have led a very certain path. And then they're thrown off that path, they're tested, they're challenged. And they meet one another in circumstances that never would have happened, like Ella and Sadie in my book. And so for my readers, if you see these people in the book who are so very different from yourself, right? And you empathize with those characters, I think it helps remove some of the otherness we're experiencing in our world today, right? Mm-hmm. Empathizing in literature will help you transverse the otherness barrier that we have so much in our society right now.
Yeah, and you're going to be sitting there saying, wait, what, I can relate to these people. I don't need to relate to everybody. I'm relating to this particular situation. But it also makes you think about when you're thinking about subjects of race, because a lot of this was, it was about religion being a race. It was to be about, you know, this was what the race was and who was ostracized and who was allowed in. It was really who's going to win, who's good, who's bad.
Yes.
So do you consider yourself a historian as well as a novelist? Do you think that you're telling history at the same way?
Yes and no. I mean, I am a historian in my own life. I have a master's from Cambridge in history, so I definitely love that. But I think a lot of writers get in trouble, if they do get in trouble, by staking a claim too large around what's real in their books. And so I never want to be the person to cross that line. So I will tell you in my books very clearly, like, what is true and what is not true, because I don't actually think that real life often makes for terrible plot, but it makes for wonderful setting. So I don't seek to write the true stories, but I want to use the true stories to create the fabric. And I never want to cross that line by overstating what I do.
And, you know, I think that one of the things we were coming across was hunger. Like, there was a constant hunger. And I think hunger is a big metaphor in this book, the hunger to get out of where you are, the hunger to go someplace besides the hunger for food. I mean, just every single day it's scrapping and getting on another line for food. And, you know, we thought toilet paper was bad. Think about doing that every single day just for something to eat and how little people would have to eat. They'd have potatoes. They'd have like X number of potatoes to last X number of days. I think that those are the things that when you sit there and think about, go back in your own kitchen and sit there and look and say, oh, like, there's so much.
You know, that's one thing, as you say, that I think about that living abroad definitely gave me is that perspective. I mean, I went to Poland in 1996, right after communism. You could not drink the water for anything. And in the winter, there were no vegetables. Like, I could plant root vegetables, but I would have to go looking for a tomato or anything like that. And I remember coming back to the States, and I still appreciate a good produce department, you know, because I didn't have, or The medical supplies were so scarce. The doctor would come to your house and ask to use a spoon because he didn't have a tongue depressor. And so I came back to America and I saw my brother, who's a doctor, blow up a rubber glove, like tie it off to amuse a patient. And he meant it well. And I had this like, you're wasting supplies kind of thing. So I think that that experience makes me feel it. But yes, certainly it's something I wish I could instill in my children, you know, that that how much we have here.
There is, I can't remember the name of the author. He was an outdoor adventurer and he got his arm caught between a rock. I can't remember what the name of the book is right now. Believe me, I remember this book every single time I'm in the kitchen. And you know how there's a little bit in the peanut butter in the bottom of the container? Yeah. It makes me crazy because I remember this guy being out in the wilderness and wanting like in this little drop of water and keeping this water that was this much going for how many days.
Yeah.
And I think about that book so much. And I finally confessed to my husband one day. I said, do you know why I'm so nuts about this stuff? Let me tell you about that book. And
yeah.
But it's one of those things where that little bit would have mattered. And yep. Throwing out that little bit, I always think about after reading that book. And I remember what the name of it is, but I don't remember now. When you talk to book clubs and have discussions, I take it you do speak with book clubs?
Sure, absolutely.
Is there anything that they bring you as surprises about your work? Like, oh, I never saw that. Oh.
All the time. Lots of the themes that I never think of until, you know, they say, and I'm like, oh yes, I meant that. Definitely. But one of my favorite things about book clubs is they will ask about stuff that happens off the page. Like, did such and such happen to so-and-so? And I'm like, like to me, I don't write the gray area off the page. And I love how much they think about it.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wait a second. How, and I was thinking about how did she get to the sewer every day? Did she walk the same way? Was she walking on different streets so she wouldn't get followed? That if anybody was going to see her, if she was going to be there, what was she going to do to not get caught being at the sewer? Was she going to drop, like, was she going to drop her glove down the sewer? What was she going to do? So I was inventing all these little scenes for her as we were.
Well, you
going
have
along.
To, because otherwise the book would be two times as long and nobody needs that.
No, no, but we were all inventing. Was there any really surprising fact that you came across, like something that you're like, really, about the sewer, about anything, you just sat there and go, never would have thought that one.
Oh goodness. I mean, the whole story of the sewer in some way is that, you know, that moment. I'm very taken by the real life man who helped the people. He was a sewer worker. He had formerly been a thief. And the things he did for them were really quite extraordinary. I mean, he brought them food. He brought them food after they had no money to pay him. He went around the city to different markets so he didn't get caught risking his own family when he was doing this. He didn't just bring them food. He brought them books. He brought them Jewish items, other things to sustain them. So he's very memorable to me in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say so too. And it's like, you know, and when he says I was the thief in my former life, it's like, this is what I, you know, did before.
Yeah.
There's a multicast narration of the audio. It's Jennifer, Jill, Araya, Emily Lawrence, and Nancy Peterson. What drew them to cast a multicast? Do you know? Did they talk to you about it?
I am not an audio person and I don't get involved in that decision. I do get to listen to narrator clips and I'm really bad at it. You know, I usually defer to my editor, but I do listen to the clips and there's questions like, should they have accents? Should they not have accents? You know, or how do you use a voice in a particular part of a book if you're not sure you want people to know who that voice might be? You know, like there's all these sort of really interesting questions. It's a beautiful finished product and I'm so grateful to the talented people who spoke on it.
Oh, that's so great. How about the cover? Was this always the title? Was it always?
No, my books get changed all the time. My titles, my covers. I have a story about that. So I was working on a book. It was not with my current publisher and it was called The Anniversary Clock. And forgive me, but I had baby twins and I was feeding twins, right? So you can't really hold the phone. And my editor called and it was like the grand bubby of all editors. And, you know, they don't call you, they email. So I put the phone like this. I'm like, yes, God. And she was like, we're changing the title from The Anniversary Clock to The Things We Cherished. And like, so that's like a classic. Now in my current situation, I get to give more input,
right.
A lot more input, but I wanted to call this book Flowers Someday.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to call it, but it did not last, but I'm super happy with the title, and the cover, and you know, I'm not artistic, I'm not visual. So by the time it gets to me, much wiser people have had their say.
Well, I will say too, there are a lot of elements. When you go to look at the cover, they're all different elements, and I didn't even notice some of them until I was looking at it today. So it's a different experience. You know, sometimes you just pick up a book and say, "Oh, I'm with the blue star." Oh, I was also calling her the girl with the blue star. I will
That's
confess,
okay.
like
Sorry.
all week I was doing
It's
that. And
easy to do. Yes, I've had every iteration of the female name, the female noun in my books.
well, you know what also too is because they were girls to me. They weren't women. They were girls at that point in the story, you
Well, it's
know?
interesting you say that because in real life, the girl who looked up was much younger than my character.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. The girl who looked up. Okay.
That
So
would be a good title, The Girl Who Looked Up. I like
the
that.
girl who looked up. See that? No, but
I
this contains so much more. So is there something next that you're working on? Are you on next?
am. So it's funny. I usually am an open book, and then I was feeling like kind of squirrely about it for a while, and then I realized I already answered this question in the reader group guide. So my next project is inspired by a true story of the only known sabotage of a train headed for Auschwitz.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a
Ooh.
really cool story. And my book looks at people on the train and people who were saboteurs. Yeah.
Ooh, so interesting. So interesting. And do you need to travel for that one? No,
I'm
nothing.
not trying. So I wish I could. I definitely, first, I owe myself a trip to Poland after last year, but for this book, it would be Belgium. But quite honestly, I'm not traveling yet. I'm waiting till my kids are vaccinated to travel.
How old are they now? How old are the kids?
I have two that are almost 11. My son's 12. He got his first shot, but my girls are not till that next group. So it's not just me. I'm modeling behavior and I want to just wait for them. And also after the past year and everything they've been through, I'm not too eager to leave them.
And also, you don't, I think people are saying you don't know when you get on a plane, when you land, what's going to happen. Like, you don't know what's happening
Yeah.
in any of these countries at this point. I mean, I have this feeling too, is like, okay, we're vaccinated, and now what?
Right.
I really am on, and now what? You
We
know?
haven't really changed anything yet, so that's
No.
fine. Yeah.
No, hey, look, we've got Zoom. I mean, come
Right.
on, we've got
I'm
Zoom.
fine. I'm
That's
in my house. I can wear whatever bottoms I want.
it makes a big difference. And you know, as much as I do like traveling and I do like seeing people,
Yeah.
there is something nice. We've gotten a lot more done, I know, at the company, for the
Yeah.
fact that we don't have an office. We're just working. We're just
Yeah.
doing our thing and figuring out what to do. And it's been a
Oh,
big
yeah.
change.
It's special. I like it.
Yeah, but by the same token, a lot of times we build websites for authors as part of what we do. And it's really funny because you could put up a screen and share a screen and talk to an author that you never would have done before. You would have been describing them to go, "Well, move this." And you're like,
Right.
"What's this?" You
Right.
know?
That's amazing. But I'm as great as this is, I'm still coming to hug you, Carol.
You're still coming to hug me. Yes, we will definitely reach out soon. Thank you
Yeah.
so much for joining us, Pam. I was looking forward
Thank
to this,
you.
and you definitely over-delivered as always.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Woman with the Blue Star by Pam Jenoff, narrated by Jennifer Jill Araya, Emily Lawrence, and Nancy Peterson, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audio excerpt from The Woman with the Blue Star, narrated by Jennifer Jill Araya, Emily Lawrence, and Nancy Peterson, courtesy of Harper Audio.
Krakow, Poland, March 1942. Everything changed the day they came for the children. I was supposed to have been in the attic crawl space of the three-story building we shared with a dozen other families in the ghetto. Mama helped me hide there each morning before she set out to join the factory work detail, leaving me with a fresh bucket as a toilet and a stern admonishment not to leave. But I grew cold and restless alone in the tiny, frigid space where I couldn't run or move or even stand straight. The minutes stretched silently, broken only by a scratching. Unseen children, years younger than me, stowed on the other side of the wall. They were kept separate from one another, without space to run and play. They sent each other messages by tapping and scratching, though, like a kind of improvised Morse code. Sometimes, in my boredom, I joined in too.
Freedom is where you find it, my father often said when I complained.
Papa had a way of seeing the world exactly as he wanted.
The greatest prison is in our mind.
It was easy for him to say. Zoe's manual ghetto labor was a far cry from his professional work as an accountant before the war. At least he was out and about each day, seeing other people, not cooped up like me. I had scarcely left our apartment building since we were forced to move 6 months earlier, from our apartment in the Jewish quarter near the city center, to the Podgorze neighborhood, where the ghetto had been established on the southern bank of the river. I wanted a normal life, my life, free to run beyond the walls of the ghetto to all of the places I had once known and taken for granted. I imagined taking the tram to the shops on the Rynek, or to the kino to see a film, exploring the ancient grassy mounds on the outskirts of the city. I wished that at least my best friend, Stefania, was one of the others hidden nearby. Instead, she lived in a separate apartment on the other side of the ghetto designated for the families of the Jewish police. It wasn't boredom or loneliness that had driven me from my hiding place this time, though, but hunger. I had always had a big appetite, and this morning's breakfast ration had been a half slice of bread, even less than usual. Mama had offered me her portion, but I knew she needed her strength for the long day ahead on the labor detail. As the morning wore on in my hiding place, my empty belly had begun to ache. Visions pushed into my mind, uninvited, of the foods we ate before the war. Rich mushroom soup and savory borscht, and pierogi, the plump, rich dumplings my grandmother used to make. By mid-morning, I felt so weak from hunger that I had ventured out of my hiding place and down to the shared kitchen on the ground floor, which was really nothing more than a lone working stove burner and a sink that dripped tepid brown water. I didn't go to take food. Even if there had been any, I would never steal. Rather, I wanted to see if there were any crumbs left in the cupboard and to fill my stomach with a glass of water. I stayed in the kitchen longer than I should, reading the dog-eared copy of the book I'd brought with me. The thing I detested most about my hiding place in the attic was the fact that it was too dark for reading. I had always loved to read, and Papa had carried as many books as he could from our apartment to the ghetto, over the protests of my mother, who said we needed the space in our bags for clothes and food. It was my father who had nurtured my love of learning and encouraged my dream of studying medicine at Jagiellonian University, before the German laws made that impossible, first by banning Jews and later by closing the university altogether. Even in the ghetto at the end of his long, hard days of labor, Papa loved to teach and discuss ideas with me. He had somehow found me a new book a few days earlier, too. The Count of Monte Cristo. But the hiding place in the attic was too dark for me to read, and there was scarcely any time in the evening before curfew and lights out. Just a bit longer, I told myself, turning the page in the kitchen. A few minutes wouldn't matter at all. I had just finished licking the dirty bread knife when I heard heavy tires screeching, followed by barking voices. I froze, nearly dropping my book. The SS and Gestapo were outside, flanked by the vile Jüdische Ordnungsdienst, Jewish ghetto police who did their bidding. It was an Aktion, the sudden, unannounced arrest of large groups of Jews to be taken from the ghetto to camps. The very reason I was meant to be hiding in the first place. I raced from the kitchen, across the hall and up the stairs. From below came a great crash as the front door to the apartment building splintered and the police burst through. There was no way I could make it back to the attic in time.